Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Before I begin, a short programming note. I will be moving and away from this computer and my internet for some time. I hope to have another episode up in 3 weeks. That's tentative, because moving is not a simple thing. Thank you for your patience. Today, I'm joined by Paige Lavoie to talk about Meddling Kids by Edgar Cantero, a horror comedy novel from 2017. We both struggled with this book, and we dive deep into our problems with it. We talk about expectations, about the uneven tone, and about unnecessary complexities in a plot. I think we both really wanted to like it, and it just didn't happen. Although I didn't like it, it was a great chat with Paige, and I think it reveals a lot about what matters to us in fiction. On to the discussion! Hello, everyone. I'm here once again with Paige Lavoie to talk about some books in a book club. Paige, how you doing?
Woo! I'm doing good.
No, hello? No. Never mind. I was expecting some snappy, spooky Scooby-Doo-ness. You know, but
I was trying to think of like some sort of pun, but yeah, I got nothing.
You tragic chuckled about the book we're reading this week. It is Meddling Kids by Edgar Cantero. Quick summary. A gang of kid detectives, a la Scooby-Doo, are grown up now and are now haunted by a mystery they solved as children and now must go back and figure out what they left unsolved or unresolved, I guess. It's Scooby-Doo meets Lovecraft meets Stranger Things meets It. I don't know. There is a sort of roundabout connection back to the Tom Swift book we did.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Because it is done in that style of Tom Swift, of Hardy Boys, this book is specifically, I think, referencing Enid Blyton because they are literally the Blyton agency or Blyton Detective Agency, whatever they call themselves as kids. And she was an author of British children's fiction of this type, of the so-called Famous Five, which is a sort of a very similar thing to Scooby-Doo. It's, you know.
Interesting. I did not know that.
The two girls, the two guys, a dog. This is, you know, it is that.
I'm just wondering if we're going to be on opposite sides of this one, or if we're both kind of had some of the same thoughts. And by some of our pauses and...
I struggled with this a lot, especially like at the 2/3 mark, I would say. I started losing patience.
Me too. I was about 50% because I also, just with like moving and all the stuff that's going on, like personal life, just, I mean, it's basically just moving and not making time for reading, if I'm being totally honest with myself. I put off reading it until like early, late weekend, like Sunday. And I'm like, okay, this sounds like a great book. I love the concept. I'm just going to binge read the whole thing. I got about 50% through and I almost messaged you just being like, what if I didn't finish it? So I managed to read the whole thing, but I almost noped out.
I stuck with it. And I generally do binge read. I read books at all in like one or two sittings. I do not read like, hey, 8% and then 12, you know, which is now that's how I look at books now, which is Kindle has broken me because it's just percentage. It's not like, hey, I got through six chapters. It is or 100 pages. It is. I am 14% of the way through this book or whatever it is, unless I'm reading something extraordinarily long, like I recently read Fellowship of the Ring, which is long. Oh, cool. So I had to parcel that one out a little bit more, but it starts off pretty well, and it has a, and like you said, I think the idea, it seemed like I looked at it and one, the cover and the packaging of it is really good. Like they did a really good job of, like the title Meddling Kids is a really strong title. The cover is really evocative and you go, oh, it's Scooby-Doo. Except, like, they're haunted, and it's Lovecraft, and you're like, oh, cool, I like all those things. Then it starts off interesting enough, and there's just too much... I don't want to call them gimmicks, but that's what it kind of... I don't know. It uses those, like I said, tragi-chuckled earlier... It has that in it has a lot of those made up verbs that we saw in the Tom Swift book, and like, and after a while of getting them over and over and over again, I was just still, huh? We're still this is what this is, and like I was I want to like it. I really do. I really want to like it. I just found myself that I think, and the thing that set it off was as the book was getting closer and closer to a climax and closer to like the ending, I found myself caring less and less. Mm-hmm.
I felt like maybe 70% of this book was the characters just talking BS with each other. Like conversations that didn't really like further the plot, like that like hazing, bantering kind of feeling, references to cases from the past. Like we understand that there were like missing sheep or something. Like how many times are you going to tell us that? Like a lot of like repeated information and like conversations that didn't matter. And I just was waiting for like the action and the mystery and to get like absorbed into like the mysteries of this town, and it just didn't happen.
Not really. I mean, it kind of,
the way it happened.
Yeah, it's not, it's, and I could deal, like when they're getting the gang all back together, I can deal with the bantering because it's like, oh, they're meeting each other again, you know, and right. And we're learning about them. We're learning how they used to have, what their relationship used to be, what they are now. And we're learning about the how this web of these people, these now adults, work. And then they get to the town eventually, and that like, and then it's just like the mystery itself is like, oh no, we have to go to the mine, and we go to the house, and then we have to go to the mine, and then we have to go back to the lake, and then we have to go back to the we're back at the house anyway, and then we have to talk to the sheriff, and we have to
the old lady.
Yeah, oh, go ahead. The old lady. I don't mind. I actually the old lady until the big swerve.
Yeah,
I was totally. I love the old lady.
She was like the only character I liked until like the twist, and I just kind of went.
You took her from me. You took.
Yeah. Can't you just let her be like a little old lady who's really grumpy? Everyone's been calling her a witch her entire life, and she writes erotica. Like,
yeah, come on. It's fun.
I lost it when they described her, and it was her manga sized eyes. I like was highlighting things and screenshotting them and sending them to my friend Taylor just like relentlessly, and she was like, please stop. This book looks terrible.
Yeah.
But and it was entertaining for me though.
Yeah, it's that's the like those are the two, like there is one that is like structural in like I want them to just to get to the plot, get to the, mm-hmm. like, this is a mystery. It is about, it's Scooby-Doo, Lovecraft, like Lovecraft stories, Lovecraftian stories are about existential horror and mystery. And Scooby-Doo is a mystery. They are, every episode is a mystery, and they're very simple mysteries, but they still function as mysteries. And this thing just swerves so much. And feels like, I feel like it wants to, like, really, like, hey, I got you, twist, M. Night Shyamalan style, like, yeah, it's a twist. And I'm like, I can't, just make it a simple thing about the dude who used to live in the house, and mm-hmm. you don't have to, like, have so many different sidetracks that get us, like, it really, so that, structurally, but the thing you talk about, the manga-sized eyes, that is not, that is, this thing is rife, full of phrases like that, which I understand what it's going for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I can maybe put on as a matter of taste, a matter of, I like this thing that is really silly and is just making up words and has silly, stupid turns of phrases. And I think it's funny. And I looked at Goodreads and tons of people love this thing. It was a bestseller. All I could say is I am not one of those people because there is, look here. I have a one highlight, Dunia, mm-hmm. thesauricized.
Wait, what was that? One more time?
Thesauricized as a verb.
Thesauricized.
Primitive chemistry. Yeah. Dunia thesauricized. Just the weird stage direction.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That started so quickly with no warning and like no transition. And it just drove me insane. And like I was reading positive reviews because I was just like, did someone like who does this appeal to? Who is this for? And I think there were some people who read this book and they liked how it broke so many rules. They liked like the made up words and all of the quirky language and the stage direction. But for me, it just took me out of the story every time they did it. And I kept hoping that I would get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I read, the more it just like irritated me. It
got worse. Yeah, that's
yeah.
It didn't get better because I was like, okay, this is like some like he like it just and it's you're right. There is no segue. There is no explanation. It is suddenly all you have all three of the characters plus the dog plus mm-hmm. the imaginary character who's mm-hmm. not who. Is and is not real at the same. I don't even want to get on about Peter.
Peter.
Gosh, like I okay, but they'll be having a normal conversation in the car or whatever, or in a house, in their headquarters, and then suddenly you just get like half a page of like screenplay, basically of character name and what they say. There's no quotation. It's screenplay format. And I'm waiting. And that's at the 2/3 mark, I think, is when I lost my patience, because I kept waiting for there to be some sort of overarching thing that explains the screenplay, the stage directions, and the way they use notate speech. I thought there was some kind of catch, like we're watching the show. Like that's like, yeah. or we're reading the screenplay of the show that this is. And I think that's what he's going for. But because it never fades back and sees as there's never a hint that this is a frame narrative, which is what I would expect it to be. That's what I was expecting. I was just like, okay. There has to be a reason that they're doing like that. He is writing all this like weird screenplay stuff in here. There's going to be a moment somewhere in this book where it fades back. It pulls back for, and we get a glimpse of a frame narrative that explains all this stuff.
Nope.
Never happens. And that's exactly what your response. It's exactly what happened to me. And I it might be because I am currently editing a manuscript that I'm a little bit more on edge about this stuff, where everything you read about revising and editing your work is you cut out everything that reads like writing. You want it to, mm-hmm. you want it to feel like you don't want to ever break that immersion, like you said. And
yeah,
this thing, nonstop. Just every time you start to get into the story, it's like, oh, wait, now they are looking at I have something. Oh, Al italicized for attention.
Oh, yeah. Andy caps locked.
I just can't.
I apparently this is a part of the author's writing style, too. I saw that in another positive review where it was like his, and I hesitate to use the word meta novel, I think is what they said.
Sure.
Style like delights some, but will irritate everyone else. And I'm like, well, I know who I am.
Yeah.
But yeah, it honestly just seemed like a book that didn't have an editor. And I feel so mean saying that. And now that I know that it's like done intentionally, like this is the author's style, this is what he goes for, I wonder if I would have known that picking up this book, if it would have made a difference to me. But I still think that I the story itself wasn't strong enough for me to accept the weirdness of the writing and kind of go with the flow. Because the other thing that really bothered me about this book is I thought the characters were really underdeveloped. I mean, he gave them all trauma. He gave them all unhealthy ways that they were coping with stuff. Mm-hmm. But they all spoke the same way. And that really bothered me, where if a character was talking, unless it specified who was speaking, you really had no way of knowing. Even at the very end, we have the old lady character, and she's talking in like the exact same like tone and way that all of the detective kids are talking. Like it just all seemed like they had the same like cadence. Same way of speaking. Yeah, cadence, same like. And I have no problem with characters who swear, but I feel like there was a certain point in time when they all started speaking the exact same way.
And I think that's the thing. Like, I think I would have enjoyed this more if it leaned harder into that these are like, this is a parody of mm-hmm. Scooby-Doo, and the characters don't have to be like quote unquote developed because it's Scooby-Doo. Like, what can you tell me about Daphne's character? I mean,
right.
You can name like the four things and then you're like, that's Daphne, and it's a cartoon. So who cares? It doesn't, it's not trying to be serious, but this book feels like it is trying to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And I like Andy, I think, because she's a hard ass, but I don't like Carrie. I don't like Nate, really. And Nate seems like mm-hmm. the layup. He is a nerd who loves reading like eldritch horror, which, hey, that's what I am. I should love this dude. He's me. But I'm just like, oh, Nate, come on. Why? And like Peter. Oh, my God.
The worst. Okay. So when they introduced Peter, I thought I was going to kind of like him because he sort of had like a boyish thing going for him. He seemed almost sweet in that one scene. Just like, I think they're in the bathroom and he was kind of like chattering for like a second. And like, the more it got into dialogue, I'm just like, oh, you're like crass and kind of a bully. And like you are not like a nice friendly ghost BFF. You're just like this
obnoxious,
gross, obnoxious, like pervy dude. Like,
and it he never really pays off the Peter, like. Mm-mm. That, and that really frustrated, like, that, like, it's a bunch of things that are introduced and none of them really, like, Peter is like a momentary twist, like, that, because it is revealed.
Oh yeah, that reveal with the take off your hood. Yeah. And then it's Peter.
But then it's just a puppet. Like, it's not even like, hey, if you want Peter to be the, like, when I think of Scooby-Doo and I think of them ripping a mask off a thing and it's the old guy that lived in mm-hmm. the well or whatever. And he's, if it wasn't for you meddling kids. And so I was totally expecting a moment where they rip off a mask and it's somebody and that's there. That's who it is. And this is the moment. And you're like, oh, it's actually Peter. But then it's not. And then it's the old lady, except it's not. She's... It's kind of the old lady, but it's actually still the person that it used to be, because he can change gender and shape whenever he wants and is immortal, I guess. I don't really know. And then she's not even the big bad. She's just it's just layers and layers of like puppets to get into, just so they can chant some words and send the elder god back down to wherever.
Yep.
So she doesn't even matter. And she's our villain. But she gets like action movie scenes.
Yeah.
And she's like with like a cutlass or something, and she's like a pirate. Like,
yeah, where did you get that? Like,
fighting the fish things, the fish monsters, and why are we seeing her fight if she's a bad guy, the villain, the antagonist? Why are we watching her be an action hero?
Yeah, and it went into her narrative, like, where it kept cutting to her, and like you said, like, why do we need any of this, especially because there wasn't really any payoff? It was just like, now follow this character around for a while, I guess. I don't know.
And then she's probably dead, who probably not, because it's whatever. She's not a, she's has powers, which so mm-hmm. she might, maybe she's a, she's probably not dead. You think she is, but she's probably not. I don't know if Peter's actually dead or not. He seems like he is, but I can't tell anymore. Because this is a horror novel, a horror comedy. That, at least that's what it says on the tin. And it starts certainly off with, like, the very beginning of the book. It checks in with, it starts with Andy and Carrie and all the kids who are now grown up. And they're all haunted. And you, like you said, they are all traumatized. They all have trauma. Like, Andy is a vagrant. Carrie is working a dead-end job, has nightmares. Nate lives in a mental asylum. And Peter is dead, theoretically. Committed suicide.
Who knows?
Whatever, we don't... Yeah, it twist. I lied to you! That's that's the twist. Book. The twist. I lied to you in the beginning of this book. But, and, like, they are all, like, enduring, like, horrible nightmares, and they're seeing terrible things. And they're gonna, that's what they're going back to defeat. And that's a good arc, I feel, mm-hmm. like, for a book. But as the book goes along, there's less and less trauma. There's less and less horror. All they're doing is fighting monsters at the end. And it's an action movie. And that's fine. And you can certainly have horror while you're fighting monsters. But... Mm-hmm. If every time there's an action sequence, it's just like, oh, we kill them all.
Yeah.
The dog lost his part of his ear. Isn't that sad? I'm like, yeah, it is. I liked him. Yeah. He's a dog, so of course I like him, but.
Yeah, best character. Man, the way they wrote the dog, I guess it finally did. Because the whole time I'm just like, wow, they really write the dog as if it's a person. And then it got to the end and I went, Oh, that's a twist I didn't need or care for. Like, oh, I just...
Tim is has a spirit inside that is a native person from thousands of years ago.
Cool. I'm so glad.
Why couldn't he just be a dog? Why couldn't you just leave it as maybe there is a spirit inside Tim, but he looks and acts like a dog, and we call him Tim, and we love him because he's just our dog. He's a friend.
Yeah, but I, no, they
really it, spelled I, out. Hey, more. Hey, we got you.
Oh man, yeah, that bummed me out. I was just like, oh, okay, let's make this one character that did not need to be complicated, extremely complicated. Also, I kept getting annoyed, like, during the scene where they had the gas masks and the oxygen, and they brought the dog, Tim, with them. And then they're like freaking out, like, we need to get out of here. Tim has a mask, but no oxygen. Like, maybe think about that. Maybe leave Tim with Al, Captain Al, crazy Al.
Poor Captain Al didn't make it.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Poor Captain Al got mushed by the big monster, the Elder God, whatever, the Lovecraft thing.
Yeah, they did. I guess I forgot because I didn't care.
Yeah, Al. That's the they introduce the townsfolk, which, you know, is Al is the cop, their old bully who's now,
yeah, freaking Joey that I hate. Continue.
Yeah, Joey. I would hate him, but he's almost nothing. So I can't really, there's not much for me to grab onto to hate. True. Like Peter, I hate. Peter, I really don't like. Every appearance of Peter, I'm like, oh, again. But Joey's just like, hey, I used to be a jerk and now I want to help. I'm a cop now. I'm a deputy. And I also work at a diner. I'm like, all right, fine. Sure, Joey. It's just they're there, but they don't really get any development. And it's not like there isn't room in this book. This thing is really long, and
yeah,
doesn't need to be this long. It doesn't. Why is it this long? Why, like, it turns like halfway from a horror novel into like a zany action movie, and that's fine, I guess. But it doesn't. Maybe that's just all it is. I don't like the zany action movie. I don't like. Yeah. I like the Scooby-Doo as true horror and not the zany action thing that it turns into.
Well, and I think like when we read, what was it? The Merciless. Mm-hmm. It had that shift at the end where it was like kind of suspense, gore. Mm-hmm. Awful. And then it turned into that like a campy horror demon novel thing towards the end. And that was a shift that like we both were like, oh, okay. I guess. But we still like followed along and got to the end. But this, I feel like the shift was so off base from what we thought we were gonna read that it was just like you wanted to give up. You wanted to be like, well, I guess this isn't what I thought it was gonna be. Yeah. I really want to find a book about, like, I want to find a book that's this concept, but done as, like, true horror, like you were saying. Like, not really, I mean, I wouldn't even mind if it had humor. It's just, like, I didn't think this book was very scary, and I didn't really think it was funny.
Right. I don't.
And that, I mean, that's all subjective, too, you know?
I mean, I hope we don't have to say that, yeah, this is...
Yeah, this whole podcast. This is all
opinion. This is an opinion piece. I am not writing down. We are not declaring anything as fact, and that's the nature of writing. I just shifting in tone. A tonal shift like this is incredibly hard to navigate. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly hard to do right. I probably would have finished even if we weren't doing the podcast because I am very stubborn and I have already read this much. I will finish this thing and maybe skim some of the long descriptions of action in the final fifth of the book where I'm just like, I don't, I know they win at the end. I don't need you to describe them shooting 50 different little monster fish monster guys and then the sword fight sequence with the evil lady. It's fine. You don't need all of that action. Like, if it was they created some sort of trap or something, like, because that's what they do. They call back to that with how they trapped the original guy. Whatever that dude's name was, I have forgotten it long ago.
With a W.
Yeah, the dude that got out of prison at the beginning of the book, and then Andy attacks him.
Yeah, which was so intense. It was like, how did you know he was going to be here? You are very strong.
Yes. She is. And then she does beat up a bar full of people, of men.
Yeah.
And I mean, she is in the military. Maybe she learned fighting stuff. But like, I highlighted this because it exhausted me trying to read it. And it is on page 280 of the Kindle edition. I don't know. I still don't know how Kindle versions work out towards the paper versions. But it's a paragraph that starts with a new throng of slimy, eyeless maniacs avalanched onto the battlefield. And it goes on for over half a page. Over half a page that is exactly one paragraph that it is a paragraph that is a run-on sentence. It is just clauses. I'm not going to count them all, but there are dozens of clauses separated by commas that is describing this long action sequence. And it hurt me. It caused me when I write action, I purposefully break up into very small paragraphs because it is hard to frame it so that people can follow along, because they're not seeing any of this. They're not watching an action movie. They're not seeing, you know, hey, look, Jason Bourne jumps to the left and then punches a guy. They have to imagine all this stuff. Theater of the mind. And there's this long, long paragraph with no periods. Only punctuation is commas. And at the end, they retreat. Nothing happens. There's no reason. Like, it's just, why is that there? Why do I have to read that? It's painful. It's hard to read. As a reader, I get to that paragraph and I go, my God, that's a giant clump of stuff. And it's all action about these guys hurting each other. But because it's been established that these people are like cartoons, I'm not worried. Their injuries don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
No one dies except for poor Al, and he dies off screen. Basically, he's just smushed by the big thing. We don't see him anymore. And then everyone else, even the sheriff, he just gets hurt. He's fine. You have to have those stakes there. There has to be that tension of, oh, anyone could die. Like, I was fully expecting one of these people to die.
I kind of wanted something to happen. Like, at least, like no one even really got hurt.
The dog got part of his ear.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The dog got part of his ear. I'm sorry. You're right. That was insensitive.
they get cuts and scrapes, but
mm-hmm.
no one, we don't see the monsters kill anyone. So why are they dangerous?
Yeah. I also was kind of disappointed that, so they walk into this town and like, it's kind of eerie and where are all the young people, and the house feels different and it feels smaller and less comfortable and comforting than it used to. And I'm like, okay, these are very normal going back to your hometown kind of feelings. But because of the book that it was in, I was expecting it to matter. Like, I was expecting something beyond the lake and the mansion area. I don't know. I guess I just was just like, is the town imaginary? Like, I just wanted more, or for them to have like more of like emotional, like an emotional journey, if that was the direction it wanted to go in. But mm-hmm. like at the end of the novel, I went, okay, so he's probably like at the end, how this story like would end in real life is you're going back to the asylum, you're going back to jail, and I don't know what's happening with Carrie, you know? So the lack of like any sort of consequences, I guess, like no one got injured, no one got caught. I don't know. It was just kind of weird.
It flies in the face of Lovecraftian fiction, which is the thing that it basically sets up a lot of expectations for me. Mm-hmm. And none of them are realized. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But when you are subverting genre tropes, you have to have a really mm-hmm. good reason for it. You have to, if you're going to be setting up expectation, oh, this is a Lovecraft novel. This is about Cthulhu mythos. And in Cthulhu stories and Lovecraft stories, generally, people go insane and die.
Right.
They're, at the end, there is no easy way out. There is cost. And even if someone lives, they probably are crazy for the rest of their lives. Or that, like, it's a giant existential threat. Like, you're supposed to see this giant monster, and your brain can't encompass that idea. And sure, it's kind of tired, that base idea at this point. You have to there, and there right now is basically like a huge resurgence in Lovecraft fiction. Not only this, I've read a lot of it recently, and a lot of it's very, very good. It is because we live in a time where I feel like that existential terror is more effective than, hey, there's a monster under my bed or something. Like mm-hmm. a vampire is not as scary as something that is huge and ominous and you can't grasp and is right. everywhere. And like we live in 2018, that is where we are. Like you feel besieged by everything, by the outside world. And that's a good stand-in for in Lovecraftian fiction. And Matt Ruff's Lovecraft Country, great, great, great novel. Nick Cutter has written a couple different recent horror novels that are Lovecraftian in different parts. And manages to mix up the mythos to make it interesting. But those novels, people pay. There are consequences for dealing with this thing. And when you mix up a Scooby-Doo story with that, you have to choose. I guess you're choosing, I go the Scooby-Doo route, and it's a happy ending, everything's fine. Or I go rooted in horror genre way of people pay, there's cost. Not everyone's going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like by indulging in that stuff in the beginning, it makes a promise that it doesn't keep.
Yeah, I agree. There was also some moments when I thought that there was some foreshadowing and then nothing happened. I mean, I guess that's like one of our big complaints this whole book. But so with the character Nate, they mm-hmm. were playing that game in the car where it was like, I don't know. One of them asked, like, how many people are in the car or what's in the car right now? And he said, nothing. And because he was already hallucinating, I'm just like, are we in one of his hallucinations? Like, I was wondering if it was going to wrap up in a way that he was still in the asylum and just imagining all of this. Like maybe like the madness that this sort of monster brings like tormented him, and it's all of the rest of the gang like looking at him being like, oh, our poor friend who was affected. I don't know. I just like, why would you include that line if it didn't mean anything? Just little things I highlighted where I was just like, ooh, I hope this is building to something. And it didn't. Yeah, it was disappointing.
It builds to a bunch of zany action at the end. And this is probably like literally the worst time that I could be reading this thing, because I am editing a manuscript right now. That is, I am cutting it to the bone, and I look at it and go, it's a thing that is now I might be irrevertibly changed, but because I've been looking at, and like it's a thing that I saw as advice, and I was like, wow, that's really smart and a very simple revision tool. And that is to look every time you use the word had.
Mm-hmm.
And not just as, not in the sense of possession, not like I had a flashlight. It is as someone did something in the past. But the word had in that use is generally actually an empty word. It's a waste. You don't, most of the time, you don't need it to make, if your sentence doesn't make sense with that word, without that word, you need to rephrase your sentence to make it stronger. You know, right. use better words. And as I was reading this thing, I saw that the word had over. I did not highlight it because I would have gone crazy. But they had done this. They had done this. They had done this. They had done this. And I'm just like, I'm losing my mind. Also, I am also, for my Simpsons podcast, I am in seasons 10 and now season 11, which is full of third acts that devolve into zany action sequences. And it is also driving me out of my mind because it is almost in every case a way to divert from meaningful character into a way to fill time and be funny. Except I do not generally find them very funny unless you are painting another level of kind of meta narrative on it. And I don't think, like, despite the fact that we mentioned all these things that are, like, references, like, we have not even touched on the amount of references that are to other things. Like, oh, the river is the Zoinks River. The, you know, they are the Blighton Hills the Blighton Summer Detective Club, which is a reference to Enid Blyton, who wrote the stuff. There's a bunch of Lovecraft references. There's a bunch of other, like, Johnny Quest and Hardy Boys references.
They referenced SNL at some point in time. Mm-hmm. Like, it aged as poorly as an SNL skit. Just, like, little things like that. The manga eyes. Like, comparisons that I feel like are... They just were...
They call attention to themselves in a very bad way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's a good way to say it.
Here's an exact quote. The radio played Groove is in the Heart, which is a radio's way of saying it couldn't care less about the mood of a scene. Which... I don't... Why would you have the radio... Why would you personify the radio? I don't understand.
Yeah. A lot of stuff was personified in like a strange way. I don't know. Some of the ways that they described the dog, too, where it was just like Tim made an expression that seemed like he was emulating comprehension. And I was like...
Here, this is the one of the stage direction. Tim, colon, parentheses... gazes queringly at the girls in a close shot for padding.
And that's the book.
I'm like, what is going on? The fish monsters, which they call Weezers, Weezer ruled that enough time had been wasted on an uneventful dialogue and charged at Andy from behind. And I'm like, why would you call attention to your own uneventful dialogue?
It did that too, where it was just like... I don't know, like, Carrie looked two paragraphs up, and I'm like, what? Stop! Don't!
Andy spat at the intended end of the chapter, pulling out the flare gun from her pocket and shooting into the dark. I'm like...
Oh my god.
I'm sorry. Like, I understand you're trying to, like, if they are either aware that they're in a story, or they are not. Mm-hmm. They're, like, either you are Deadpool, or you are not. Like, you can't have it both ways.
True. Yeah, you gotta, like, go for it or don't, because I don't know if you can hear the thunder hopefully it's just setting the mood for this podcast.
Exactly. It is also, you know, it's Florida summertime. It is.
While I was finishing up reading it yesterday, I was sitting in a coffee shop, and I was reading what should have been a really intense, scary scene, and all of the power went out. And it was pretty amazing. And it was like just this crazy thunderstorm, sat in the dark for like a minute or two, and then the lights kicked back on. And I was like, wow, if this book was actually scary, I would be so freaked out right now.
Two blank lines later, they were still sitting there. They take a paragraph break and then reference the paragraph break. And it just feels so self-indulgent. And
I really want to know how the print version is formatted, because we both read it on Kindle. And I'm wondering if there are more breaks, if when it goes into script format, it kind of like because we as ebook readers didn't get any sort of like break. Apparently at the beginning of the book, the newspaper clipping is there in print, which I thought would have been kind of cool. But yeah, I wonder if the paperback folks have any like grace in this department just with the way it's formatted at all.
I don't know.
I don't know if it would have made a big difference, honestly, but it kind of would have been, I don't know. The next time I'm at a bookstore, I feel like I'll pick it up and flip through it just for curiosity's sake.
And I think the most frustrating thing to me is that I can see the core of this and the thing that I really like up to halfway, up to where they kind of get to the town and they start doing stuff. Like, I really mm-hmm. like the potential there. I like a lot, like, oh, maybe they are going to, maybe they realize, oh, we're in a story. And mm-hmm. maybe, like, that's like, I was thought, like, oh, Nate is reading all this fiction. Maybe he accidentally stumbles across their fiction. Or, and then they are, like, trying, and, like, then that immediately makes Andy, like, exposing the end of the chapter and refusing the chapter end. That makes sense. It makes the stage direction make sense. It makes...
Yeah.
What? It doesn't happen. It just...
I know. I would have really liked that, though. At least some sort of tie-in. I don't know if it would have saved the book for me, but it would have just, like, felt like it... Like, maybe he's writing the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
Or... I don't know. Just something.
And Peter's an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was, this is him performing, he is performing as, like, after that he has joined, like, I don't know. That's the, like, there's all these things in there. I'm like, maybe that's it. And just...
Or if Peter would have written it, and it was like, they kept talking about this last letter that Peter sent, and ended up just being really ordinary, but, like, that could have been interesting if she would have opened it up and it would have been like the script that they've been in this whole time. Something. I don't know. It was already so meta that I feel like you might as well
do it. And I really wanted the Andy Carrie relationship. Like,
oh my God, I've been waiting for you to bring that up. And it was going to be my next thought too. Okay. So what were your thoughts? Cause I have a bunch.
I was like, because the Velma Daphne thing in Scooby-Doo mm-hmm. has surpassed just, they're actually lesbians. And that was always the thing growing up. You know, you'd mm-hmm. watch, you know, at a certain point, you would hit an age where everyone, when you talked about Scooby-Doo, you're like, oh, yeah, the two women are obviously lesbians. Come on. And then... the people who talked, like, who started those rumors, because I don't think the original Scooby-Doo had any, it was not, that thing was just trying to get out as many cartoons as they possibly could right. in a very short amount of time. They did not, there was no secret context about any of those characters. But then you watch the modern Scooby-Doo, like all the different revisions, and those movies especially, which are full of secret the live action movies are full of like secret references to, you know, like Shaggy being a stoner and all that stuff. But even the cartoons have several thing like little tiny like context clues for adults, which hint at, you know, Daphne and Velma being lesbians or being in a relationship. Like, they change clothes from time to time, and you're like, how could they, why would they be wary each other? Like, the things like that. And so, like, okay, Andy is a lesbian, and she has a crush on Carrie, and Carrie's, like, not sure about her feelings. And for a while, I'm like, okay, let's see what happens. And, like, they have the sweet scenes in her old room where that room is safe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of those, the few, like, diamonds in this thing where I'm like, oh, that's a really fun. And, like, that's not unique to horror fiction. Like, there's tons of, seated throughout millions of novels is, like, this idea of, like, this is a sanctuary. This place is safe and no monster can get here. And right. The fact that it's them sharing it together, it felt like it was really sweet. like, I don't know, like, I don't know what, I don't want to necessarily say that it was handled sensitively, but it, I felt like it was at least, it was, I think, going for that. It was going for, this is, a, their relationship is special, even if, who, it might not actually end up being romantic or not, but right. they do respect each other, and Andy, you know, and Carrie, even if she doesn't return the interest that Andy does, she is at least respectful that Andy has felt that way this whole time and finally tells her, and they have this, at least that kind of schism of honesty between them is out.
Yeah, and I like that she didn't, I mean, I'm glad that the author didn't make Carrie freak out or anything like that. Like, they kept the friendship strong. The things that bothered me were after Andy confesses to Carrie, we have Carrie saying, I don't like girls. And then Andy immediately is like, well, like, have you tried? Which, like, moving past all of that, I just feel like Carrie was, after saying, I don't like girls, Carrie was then play flirting with Andy. Because I guess after I read her say that she wasn't interested, I assumed, okay, I guess she isn't interested. But then she was saying all these things that seemed like it was interested. And I'm like, well, I guess she could be considering the possibility. Maybe there were feelings she didn't know existed. But the whole time, it kind of seemed like she was leading her on. Like, just being like, oh, well, you're really good at flirting. Like, I guess it just, it seemed like Carrie didn't respect Andy very much. And that really bothered me. So after we have Andy like blow up at the diner because Joey, who was their high school or I guess middle school bully, mm-hmm. she like storms back to the house and she slams the door, and Carrie's comforting her kind of, but she's also just telling her to get over it. And it's like, well, this is like a big bully who made fun of like her identity. And it seemed like Carrie, I'm rambling because it's like, I don't know. It made me so angry. I was just like, she's supposed to be one of your really good friends. We know that she's in love with you. And yet while you're like flirting with her just a little bit, talking about like sharing beds and all sorts of like things that were like kind of, it felt like teasing to me. And then when Andy starts to mention like, oh, I don't know how comfortable I am with something or other, I can't remember what it was, she was just like, here, look at these love letters that Peter sent to me. Why would you not want to see them? Why would that make you uncomfortable? And I'm just like, are you flipping kidding me? You just found out she's in love with you and you're showing off love letters? Like, that's so like hurtful.
It,
I don't know.
I feel like it suffers from the same problems that the rest of the book suffers from. Mm-hmm. And it is not exclusive. It's not excluded from that, in that it sets off a really interesting potential at the beginning as you learn about the relationship and Andy basically willing to die for Carrie.
Right.
And there is such potential there just because of those feelings. Like, anytime you have two characters that have feelings for each other, and like, it could go a thousand different ways. You could have Carrie realize that she likes Andy and that she wants to be in a relationship. She could turn her back on Andy. She could hate Andy because Andy is making things uncomfortable for her. She could end up betraying Andy, or Andy could, she, Carrie could try and be a friend to Andy, and Andy could end up sacrificing herself for Carrie, which is what I totally thought was going to happen. I totally thought Andy was going to end up dying in like some heroic fashion to save Carrie. It felt total, even after Carrie says like, yeah, I'm not really into you. And then I'm like, okay, that's like really, and then that leaves Carrie with really interesting like pain because she's like, oh, I rejected her. And then she sacrificed herself for me. Like, that's really interesting. It just, it never, nothing ever happens. It's just like, oh, we have other characters. We also have to worry about Peter and his bad plots, and we have to worry about Nate being there or not being there. We have to, like, it just felt like because there's all these other characters and all this action happening, the Andy Carrie stuff, what it feels like, is not necessarily like purposefully like, oh, we need to just treat Andy like dirt, which is kind of her deal anyway. She is kind of the character that has a lot of outside forces always attacking her.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes more of that, and it loses its kind of specialness.
Yeah, I think it had the potential to be really special, but I think also Carrie just wasn't likable. Like, the whole time I just wanted Andy to get over Carrie and be like, okay, this is your first love. Mm. You're back in your hometown. Maybe through this experience, you're going to say, you know what? I want to find someone who is going to treat me well and really love me back. Mm-hmm. But it's just not that book. Like, they weren't going to handle it with like
no
sensitivity. Like, I Andy being the constant butt of the joke really got to me, where I was just all the characters treated her like crap. They made a bunch of like sex change jokes that I thought were handled very like
poorly.
Icky. Yeah. It was just, I saw an Amazon review that said, they were like, the book has like some transphobic tones. And I totally picked up on that, where it felt in a way that if you were watching like a sitcom or a comedy from the 90s, and there are jokes that are just like dated really poorly. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel kind of embarrassed and uncomfortable. And you go, oh, like, you're really going to speak that way to another character? You're really going to talk about those subjects that way? Like, these are real people. And then it's released in 2017. And I get they're trying to do like a vintage vibe, but it's like, maybe
you don't have to.
You can have vintage aesthetics without like trying to put like closed-minded values in. I don't know.
I think the larger problem is you have to make a choice. Like, okay, so it's set in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, people were more transphobic then. But my characters weren't. Because if you're including that in your art, not even just a book, but anything, if you're going to have it, you have to treat it seriously. You have to make the book about it. Like, and you can't just throw it in as, hey, it's a joke, and then forget about it, and everyone lives happily ever after. And you're like, well, why is that just like a thrown in thing, like here, there, and everywhere? Like, either you address it, or you don't, and you just don't include it. And that's not even about, like, I would say it's egregious in the case of the transphobic jokes because they stand out, but
yeah,
it's not just the transphobic jokes. There's a lot like we've talked about it this entire episode. It's a bunch of stuff that's thrown in here, and then it's not given any time or attention. And you're like, well, why is it in here at all? Why do I need to know that? If you're going to include information, it should be important. Everything should be important. There's nothing should be thrown away. There's no filler. You don't want filler in your book.
Right. I know, we're just like screaming into the void after this one.
I've finished this book like 2 weeks ago, and I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking about it the entire time, and it's been in my brain. I'm like, I don't want to be mean, but I can't. It's what I see. I don't know if this is like Cantero is Spanish. So I don't know if this was, I don't know if he wrote this in English or is this if it was translated.
I believe it was written in English, okay. But even if it was translated, like, I hire a better translator. Like, I don't know.
It makes sense that it was written in English because it has all the words like tragi-chuckled, which I don't think there are Spanish equivalents to that, but at least not that I learned.
Could be.
Yeah, that's very true. I don't speak. I took 3 years of Spanish, and I know very little. I remember almost none of it. Biblioteca. It's very, I think all the horror elements that are early on in the novel are swept away, and that's the stuff I liked.
Yeah.
And it, I don't want to necessarily say, oh, the book, I don't want to say that it's bad, but I would say I wouldn't recommend it. I certainly wouldn't, like, I have friends who I have friends who like horror. They love, you know, they grew like me. They grew up on Stephen King and Dean Koontz. And now Joe Hill is kind of that person. And I there's like kind of a new vanguard of horror coming along. At least I hope. I really want horror to be like, I feel like horror is a very important genre. And I wouldn't recommend this book to them. I would say it's a zany kind of Scooby-Doo book. It's not really what you're looking. If you're looking for horror, this is not it. Also, I don't think it's very particularly funny, which is the other thing. That's the problem. Like, if it was really funny, I could forgive all that.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I've read horror books that were funny too. Like, I mean, Kill the Boy Band, it's YA horror. And it is like, there were moments where I was like actually laughing out loud. And then there were moments when, I guess it's a little bit more of a mystery, but it has horror elements, but basically like it can be done. And I just, this book missed the mark for me on like a lot of different places. And I don't know. I think strong, well-developed characters that had interesting plot lines
are universal.
Would have been, yeah, would have been nice.
They're good in everything. It doesn't matter what genre you're writing in.
Yeah.
Having good characters with like interesting arcs is really, really important. And
yeah,
I wouldn't say that any of these characters, like, they all have trauma, but none of it is addressed really. And like Nate at one point retreats, he runs away. And then almost immediately runs back. Like, stood out in like in a lot of other scenes where it felt like we needed this character away from the other characters for a second. So he decides to run away for a second. And then he comes immediately right back after he argues with his imaginary friend who isn't imaginary, but actually maybe, and like, it's never settled. It's never any of that. There's no answers. And I'm like, it's a mystery. I want those things answered at the end of the book. I don't know. I think if my expectations weren't so high, I probably wouldn't care so much.
We were expecting a lot. I think, I think both of us were pretty like hyped for this book.
I mean, like it's a lot of things I like. It's like, hey, it's chocolate and peanut butter together. Yeah. I'm like, but it turns out it's more like eel and ice cream. And you're like, I like eel and sushi and I like ice cream a lot. Turns out together, not so much. Not a big fan. And
That's the Amazon review right there.
Yeah. Horror, hey, I'll say this. Horror and comedy together are very hard. It's very difficult. Yeah. And like the thing, like the ones that do it really successfully, I can count on maybe two hands. It's not, there's not a lot of it. And I think a lot of people try. And I think oftentimes this is so popular and so well liked. I don't know. Maybe I am just a crazy person. Maybe we are both just crazy. And this is actually an amazing novel. But I'm glad. I'm so glad, Paige, that you were with me on this hate fest. Because I was really worried that you were going to like, no, I really liked it. And then I'm like, I'm going to have to like try and be
gentle. I was
gentle.
Worried about that too. I'm just like, I need to find one redeemable quality about this book. I mean, and then I couldn't find anything.
It's there. It's just buried underneath a lot of other stuff. Like, I feel like if you cut out all the weird stage direction, if you just resolve the plots, like made it a little bit simpler. Like, I feel like it's really, this thing becomes really complicated. Like at the second half, like the first half is okay. We need to get everyone that was in the gang that's still alive. We need to get them all together and we need to get to the town.
Right.
And they do that. And I think that part is really enjoyable. And then they get to town and suddenly what seems like should be a simple mystery becomes this incredibly complex thing of like mines and fish monsters and this erotica writer lady who turns out to be a warlock and the and then they're doing autopsies on a fish monster and then they have to blow up a chemical plant. Like why do they need, you don't need to do all this complicated stuff. Like all you have to do is have them resolve their individual arcs and figure things out as a group. Like,
yeah, I literally thought that they were going to get there, go to the house, and then it was going to be like a haunted mansion.
Yeah,
like discover like, some sort of real monster, like a
Scooby-Doo episode. Maybe.
Yeah, I thought it was. Call me crazy, but I thought maybe.
Yeah,
it might be a Scooby-Doo episode.
Okay, yeah. I think we should.
We could probably continue to yell about this book for hours.
I could point out more of those little tiny, those words that drove me crazy, or the examples of the stage direction, which I'm like, why is only this much of it like that too? Why is it just jump in and out of it? If every book like that is every book of his is like that, at least I know. And now I know.
Yeah. I felt so bad because my inner monologue, it got to the last page and it's like, if you'd like, you know, for more of this, check out this next book. And I went, I'm good. Not for me.
Swipe right.
Someone else is going to be delighted by that, but I am not that person.
No, not me. Not me either. Okay. Paige.
Yes.
where can they find you and your things? Your books? Oh, where can they buy your books?
You can buy my books on Amazon.com. If you type in my name, Paige Lavoie, both of them will come out. Speaking of horror, hey, I have two short stories in two separate horror anthologies that came out a couple weeks ago. So there is Demonic Household. I wrote a story about a tea set that's possessed by a demon. No big deal. And then I also wrote in Thrill of the Hunt, Urban Legends, and the story is based on the idea of a camera that can steal souls. And other than that, all the social media stuff is just under my name and probably in show notes or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Everything that has been mentioned is I will do my darndest to get in the show notes. Usually I just copy and paste from the last time you were on the episode. Ooh. Which makes it very easy. Are those collections available on Amazon as well?
They are, yeah.
Okay. I'll have those in the show notes as well, because that makes it very easy. You can find all that writing. I think both the Paige's books are better than this one.
Thank you.
That is my, I mean, I did just spend an hour kind of ripping this thing apart, but yours have characters that they resolve their arcs and it, like simple things like that. Paige. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Yay. Yelling about books. That could be the name of this podcast.
Yelling about books is a good. Hey, very good. Hey, next time on Yelling About Books. Thanks again to Paige for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Norman. And the show's website is serialfanaticist.com. You can follow my Facebook page at facebook.com/serialfanaticist. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps out the show, helps me out. Subscribe, tell your friends. All those good things. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.